I have a quote from this book, X Descending, that we're going to talk about. Our guest is Chris Lambright, coming up in just a moment. He talks about some of the skullduggery and shenanigans that go on in the UFO field. Disinformation, you know, UFOs, the whole big picture is not as simple as it might seem sometimes. The government tells us, there's nothing to it. We don't study this stuff. We don't care about it. We don't pay any attention to it. It's not a matter of national security. But their actions, the actions they take behind the scenes, often belie that public position. And the case in point is a tragic story that we're going to explore tonight. The story of Paul Benowitz, a guy who filmed what he saw, what looked like UFOs, over something called the Manzano Weapons Storage Area outside of Albuquerque, where they supposedly store nuclear weapons. And he felt that he spotted something that sure as heck looked like they were flying UFOs out of there. And he started filming him. And what happened to him is absolutely terrible. In this book, there's an excerpt which says, "The events that began with Paul Benowitz filming vehicles over the weapons storage area provide the most compelling case yet of the national security apparatus descending on a witness to this phenomena." And they go on to say, "Was this a legitimate security operation, an abuse of power, or both?" And I think we're going to find it was a little bit of both. We take our break now, come back with Chris Lambright, author of X Descending, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Christian Lambright is a former investigator for the Center for UFO Studies and a contributor to the Computer UFO Network. He holds a degree in psychology from Baylor, has worked extensively in computer technology and internet services, and has a background in graphic arts and illustration, currently living in Central Texas. And he's written this excellent new book, an e-book, called X Descending and the Paul Benowitz Case, UFO Case, making his first Coast to Coast appearance. Chris, glad to have you here.
Hi, thanks, George. It's nice to talk to you after all these years.
Yeah, it is good. You know, I read this today and my head's still spinning. Obviously, there's a lot more in the book than just Paul Benowitz, but I want to start with this way to give a framework to our listeners. You know, those who are just casual sort of UFO fans and are interested in the topic, read a book or two here and there, may not be familiar with the Benowitz case, but it is something that really so much came out of it that we are still dealing with. I mean, so many ramifications that we're still dealing with, wasted effort on the part of a lot of researchers tracking down what turned out to be false leads. Am I overstating that?
Not at all. That's actually very accurate. I think many people would be surprised to find the number of major topics of the last 10 years, even current day, that if you really connect the dots, would tie straight back to what came out of the Paul Benowitz case.
Things like MJ-12.
Yes.
And a much longer list that we can get into.
Yes, sir.
Why don't we start with Benowitz? Describe how you first heard about him and who he was.
I was actually in Texas at the time, and somewhere along the way, the word began to drift out of somebody in New Mexico that was picking up, at the time it was already being said as picking up strange signals. It was my friend Tommy Bland who first brought it to my attention, and subsequently, as things really began to develop after around 1983, it became much more mainstream, well known. And at that point, something began to kind of bother me, and I began to think the Air Force would not call a man down to a meeting on base if all he was picking up was signals out of the air and thinking that it was, aliens or whatnot. I mean, I think that would have been a public relations kind of a disaster if they had been calling somebody to come down to the base to talk about that. So at one point, finally, I picked up the phone and called him. And, of course, I was all hearing, just like everybody at the time, was a lot of the other things that had been, that we now, I think, look back on as part of the disinformation that was being pumped into him. But at some point, I finally asked him, I began to think, I asked him, what did you first call the Air Force about? And he said, it was the films that I got from my roof. And that was at the time the first that I had been aware of this. And keep in mind, like most people at the time, I was focusing on the time frame around the middle of 1980 when the documents supposedly were being released at about that time, and there were mentions of Benowitz at the time. And so everybody tended to think all of this had been happening, somewhere right around the middle of the year. But it wasn't until later on that I realized, no, he had taken these films from his roof way back early in the year. That was one of the first eye-opening kind of things to realize that, wait a minute, he got these films long before any of the other kind of hodgepodge of documents began to come out. So clearly there was a time gap in there between when he had actually gotten this and afterwards. But as I began to talk to him about it, it was actually at one point in Dallas, I had been invited to give a talk. I think it was the local MUFON group. And I was talking to Paul at the time. And so I asked him if, I wanted to speak on what he had gotten, the films he had gotten. And he sent me a box about 18, 20 inches by 24 inches, FedEx box, with mounted photographs in them that I don't know for certain, but I am almost certain these had been prepared and probably were ones that he presented at the meeting at Kirtland Air Force Base, the way they were mounted, the way everything was on there, even the original small Polaroid snapshot that he had taken on his ride with Gabe Valdez was mounted on this. I mean, it was an act of faith for him to send that. But I remember at the time opening that box and looking at those pictures. And as I mentioned in the book, the first I'd heard from Bill Moore a year or so before that and in passing was, it was just a little light. But when I, as you can see in the pictures in the book now, even with computer enhancement, but seeing those pictures in that box, I opened them up and I thought, these are not just little lights.
Well, Chris, we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's for the benefit of the audience that's never heard of Benowitz, tell me what kind of guy he was. Was he credible?
To my knowledge, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, he was credible. I will say much of what he talked about at the time, things that he had been involved with that I suspect at the time he still felt had credibility, you know, whether it was things going on up north or the communications he believed he was getting. A lot of that, there were times that I think he was a little frustrated, and I think there's been some other things written that suggest he wasn't, you know, positive whether everything he was getting was what it seemed to be.
But tell me who he was. Tell me what he did for a living, where he lived.
He owned a company in Albuquerque called Thunder Scientific. It's still there, I believe. It's operated by his sons. He had had that company for a while, and it was right outside the gate of Kirtland Air Force Base. I mean, you can see the entry right across the street. And I believe they built lots of different types of equipment, but primarily some, you know, humidity monitoring equipment, things along this nature, and had contracts with, I had heard at one point that they had some of the stuff that might have been on the space shuttle, but they had contracts with plenty of military agencies at the time. And so he was somebody with credibility way beyond just you and me. I mean, he had credibility for his company, and he lived in the Four Hills area, which was, I suppose you would say, the more upscale part of housing area just to the east side of Albuquerque that, in fact, is about a quarter of a mile from the tip end of the Manzanos. But he was somebody with a reputation, and I have a feeling that when he called the base and told them who he was, of course, that meant he was not somebody to easily just be, you know, sloughed off. But he had, from my understanding, had an interest in UFOs, and I know he had an interest prior to that because I believe he had sat in on the FBI meeting up in regarding the cattle mutilation situation kind of
right
back earlier in 79. And I believe that's where he, in fact, first met Gabe Valdez. And much of his original, I guess, experiences had involved areas upwards in that locale, which is where the whole idea of Dulce and the Archuleta Mesa and that kind of thing comes in.
Right. So he had an interest in the cattle mutilation stuff. There had been a big news conference about an investigation, and he went and attended that. And then that leads him to the legend of Dulce and the underground base, right?
I think in the long run, it was the fact that he already had an interest in that area, and it was therefore convenient as quickly as possible to get his attention back up there where many more things could be staged and he would not be looking over the fence line down at in Albuquerque any longer.
So therein are the seeds of his destruction, in a sense, because he already had an interest in UFOs. And back in those days, the stories of the underground bases hadn't really filtered out to all of ufology, let alone to the public at large.
Not at all. In fact, I'd be hard-pressed to even say that I heard any allegations of, especially not like what we hear today, but allegations of underground bases anywhere in the Archuleta Mesa or Dulce area at all. It's things that stemmed from Paul's interest in that area that ultimately have led it to be kind of what it is today.
Okay, so we have this businessman, successful businessman, who has sells scientific equipment, smart guy, deals with the military, happens to have an interest in esoteric, weird topics like UFOs and cattle mutilations. And in 1979, he starts seeing and recording something over the base. Pick up the story there.
Yeah, in fact, in 1979, he, throughout the last half of the year, of course, he had been on a couple of trips up to the area around Dulce because of what he had seen up there when he'd gone to visit Gabe Valdez. And he made another couple of trips up there. One of them, from what the written material I have that he sent me, was a trip that he made with his son. So they were doing something. He was kind of focusing on some things up there. But one night after this second trip, and the best I was able to place as far as the time frame goes, was sometime he'd gone up there probably late October or November of 79. And after he came back from that last trip, his wife mentioned something that she had heard, and the dog had started barking in the wee hours of one of the mornings, some loud sound of either a buzzing noise of some sort, something that she seemed to think was coming from over the house. And this is what he described as his first kind of thought that maybe something, and I think the way he worded it was, maybe something that he had been paying attention to or too much attention to up north had followed him back to the Albuquerque area. I was never able to place any real connection there. Maybe it was just a synchronicity of some sort. But needless to say, it was the fact that she mentioned this that got him thinking perhaps he should get up on his rooftop and just kind of observe the area around his home in Albuquerque. And from my understanding, the top of his roof, if you get up on the deck, you've got almost a panoramic view of the entire area. And having been there, I mean, he definitely had a catbird seat view of the Manzanos, and from up on top of his roof, he had a much more clear view than those of us who would stand on the ground at the fence line. But it was, I don't know if it was the first night, but the impression that I got was very shortly, may have been the first night when he was up there. And I want to make a point. It's something that I found very interesting that both Paul and Ray are people who are determined enough to stay out there for whatever reason. That obviously he described very cold temperatures, so what would drive a guy to stay out on his roof but at that temperature time, at that time of the year and that temperature. But needless to say, first thing he described was seeing some odd glows off in the distance towards the Manzanos. He couldn't tell if they were on the ground or right close to it. But the description that he stated was over a period of minutes, these things would glow slightly. But then at some point, there was a sudden flash as though something came from beneath one of these objects. And within a matter of seconds, boom, a bright, almost a bluish halo, and the things would take off, shoot, glowing brightly. And his description was that it was almost bright enough that he expected to hear an explosion come rolling across the plain. But there was no sound at all. It was just a bright burst. The things would jump up off the ground, I think it was estimated 300 or 400 feet. And almost in synchrony, that's one of the reasons he began to kind of monitor the signals that were in the area, because he believed if these things are acting the timing is so good, there must be some communication that may be modulated. I mean, a lot of that's speculation, but that's what got him started with it. But they jumped off the ground, took off down south, and went around the corner of the mountain, and obviously shocked him. But over the next few days, and I could never tell if it was consecutive nights or whether he sat out there and every day or two something would happen, but he got out there with my understanding was he had a Hasselblad camera by that time. He had another camera mounted on a telescope. The Hasselblad, I think, had a 250-millimeter lens, and he had his 8-millimeter camera. So the guy was was loaded for bear as far as that's concerned. And some of what he described was times that even his wife came out, and they would watch these things out there. And it got to where he could tell her, you know, when they saw that flash and he knew things were about to happen, to watch. And he got it on film, and I talked to my friend the other day. He said, boy, with a 250-millimeter lens, what other pictures might he have had that we've never seen? I mean, all I have is kind of copies of what he sent me. But this went on for several nights, and he even got out there early enough one night to describe seeing one of them. It may have been all of them, but I think he only described one, coming in from around the backside of the mountains. And in 5 seconds, not like a helicopter would come in and kind of feel its way out for a place to land. It would come around the land, find a place, go straight down, and in less than 5 seconds, lights out. So the timing was essential. It was done on some of the coldest nights of the year, no moon, late at night. I can only imagine that's so that the less likelihood of somebody being out there watching. And it sounds to me like to keep a low out, instead of coming over the mountains to land, going around the south side and coming up, Sounds like you're trying to stay below radar, perhaps, or at least low enough to not be overtly visible as something unusual. You know, you might be passed off. But he got these things on film. I believe it was still a piece of film that he had actually shot when he had been up in the north side of New Mexico. But subsequently, that's when I began to wonder, well, okay, if he got these on film and went and had it developed, how long would you wait before you called the Air Force if you were going to? And that's when I began to think, you wouldn't have waited 6 months. And it was finally in some papers that I found that Ernest Edwards had written that Edwards stated to a couple of men from Sandia that his first contact with Paul was in January. So I know it's way up at the beginning of the year, and the dates and the temperatures to me calculated it to be right about the middle of December of 79.
Well, we'll get into that. I just want to, before we leave, what he was seeing. I mean, for all intents and purposes, he's seeing what looks like UFOs, flying saucers, coming in and taking off from Kirtland Air Force Base.
Well, from the Manzano weapons storage area.
Manzano, right.
And I believe from his calculations, down inside the electrified fence line, or at least down in there where where you would not expect to see things like this coming and going that easily.
And, you know, I guess at one point he figures, gosh, this might be some kind of a threat to the weapons that are stored there.
Yes. In fact, he said it was one of the facts. One of the points was that he didn't see any alarms. There was apparently no reaction that led him to think maybe they have no idea. And maybe there's some way that they're not visible to the people on the mountain, or they're not being seen, which was what led him to call the Air Force. I mean, he thought he was doing the right thing. Unfortunately, it maybe trusted the wrong people at that point. But
you write in the book that at one point he saw what looked like a guy's walking underneath these craft with the flashlights.
Yes, a very telling thing. And like I've said before, I wouldn't be surprised if he took some pictures of that too. But where those pictures are, you know, we can only hope that maybe his family has them locked away. But to describe what looked like a light, brighter than a regular flashlight, but apparently from the movement, I assume the bobbing around, it was pretty clear to him that somebody was wandering around on the ground carrying some kind of a light source, you know, a bright flashlight.
So he sees these things coming in and out. They might be a threat. No one else who's on the ground there, the security forces, seem to be paying any attention to them. So he assumes, well, maybe there's some kind of light reflection system that shields them from being seen. I'd better tell the Air Force.
Yeah, something's going on. So he calls the Air Force, doing what he thought, you know, was, I presume, the right thing to do.
And
in fact, he told me when I asked him at one point, and I think I mentioned this in the book, you know, at one point I actually did ask him, I said, Paul, don't you think you kind of let the cat out of the bag? And you call the Air Force, and his quote was, well, you just can't be too paranoid. And I understand what he was thinking at the time, but of course, hindsight's 20/20.
But of course, they sure made him seem paranoid by the end of this, because after calling the Air Force, he set off a chain reaction of events that led certainly to his demise and a whole lot of trouble for him. We'll pick up that part of the story after this break. My guest is Christian Lambright, who's the author of this new book, X Descending and the Paul Benowitz UFO Case. I do want to mention that a couple of minutes ago, when I was talking about the song that we were playing, I mentioned Dan Galanti. Actually, I called it Gallardi, and that's my mistake. I just interviewed a guy here in Las Vegas named Gallardi. Dan Galanti is the guy there at Premier who helps me in innumerable ways in preparing for the show each time I host, so I apologize for screwing up his name like that. Just had a little mistake there. We're going to take a break now. This is the late Bob Welch. The song is Ebony Eyes from 1977. As you know, you may know, Bob Welch took his own life earlier this month. Kind of a sad story. He was a smart and talented guy. Stay with us, everyone. We'll be back with more of our guest, Chris Lambright, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Chris Lambright, author of the new ebook, X Descending, about the Paul Benowitz case. And as we've learned so far, Paul Benowitz, living in Albuquerque, seeing some strange stuff flying in and out of the Manzano weapons storage area, highly secure area outside Kirtland Air Force Base, where nuclear weapons were supposedly stored. He sees what looks like flying saucers coming in and flying out, and he gets them on film. And then he makes the mistake of calling the Air Force to tell him what he has. What happened after that is tragic by any standards. We'll pick up the story right after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Chris Lambright about a UFO researcher and engineer and a businessman named Paul Benowitz, who videotaped or recorded footage of some odd objects that look like flying saucers zipping around over the Manzano weapons storage area outside Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque. And Chris was kind enough to share with us some of those original photos that he obtained from Paul Benowitz. We put them on the website, on the Coast to Coast website. You can get a look at them so you know what we're talking about as we hear the story unfold. Chris, let's pick up the tale there. Benowitz sees these things. He records footage of them, and then he calls the Air Force to tell them what he's got and what happens from there.
The first person that he reached, to my understanding, was Lieutenant Colonel at the time, Ernest Edwards, who was responsible. I guess he was a major, rather, at the time. But he was responsible for the security guards that were on the mountain. As he put it, those were his men. Of course, that's where it gets a little bit gray. Though we know that Paul first spoke with Ernest Edwards, it's what exactly Ernest Edwards did instantly that's where this several months of kind of gray area comes in. I have no doubt, especially from some other things that I mentioned in the book, that Edwards would have immediately either referred Paul to probably Richard Doty, or he would have possibly called his own boss and gotten Doty on the phone. And at that point, I suspect that's pretty close to the time that Richard Doty went and, to my understanding, first met with Paul at Paul's office right outside the gate. But if you'll notice, there's no documentation that's ever come out for any of this early time period. Everything seems to be wanting to direct towards the middle of the year, August, September, October, November. But if Paul called and Ernest Edwards had told two of the gentlemen from Sandia that he first spoke with Paul in January, then obviously, in my opinion, at that point, everything afterwards becomes a little bit questionable, because now the cat is out of the bag. And what the Air Force would be doing, and it's one of the reasons that I put so much time and effort into the chapter on counterintelligence work, that I was kind of, my eyes were opened by some people that I met, that in a case like this, security doesn't sit around and wait for someone to call and then try to decide what to do. That there were probably already some irons in the fire on what might happen. So when Paul called, there was probably already some I guess you'd say some plans on what to do if somebody happened to see this, because I just personally have a difficult time believing things would come in and out of that area without somebody knowing. And since Paul was able to film them, they were so bright, he was able to see them, it's hard for me to imagine they weren't visible, at least by somebody or someone else, and on the mountain itself. But from the moment he called the Air Force, and at least called and spoke with Ernest Edwards, and presumably put right in touch with, let's say, Richard Doty, who's the only other person who's really been well-known or well-named. At that point, that's kind of when I began to believe, the fix was in to defuse him, as Bill Moore put it, to fill Paul with as much information to pick up on what he was thinking, feed that back to him to lead him into at least thinking what they wanted him to think. And, of course, the whole question of this computer system that was first mentioned by Greg Bishop, that allegedly was given to Paul to facilitate him communicating with aliens. My impression is that was all part of the fix.
Let's back up for a second, because I don't want to lose the audience here. There's an allegation in your book that J. Allen Hynek, gave a computer to Paul Benowitz to assist him in his research, presumably to find out if aliens are visiting Manzano. And somehow this computer was rigged so they can keep an eye on what he was up to.
Well, to clarify, I guess you say an allegation in my book. I reference where I first heard this, which was in Project Beta by Greg Bishop, which was a book well worth reading, in which he claims to have been told this, if I'm not mistaken, by Bill Moore himself, claims that Hynek, for whatever reason, told Bill Moore that he'd been asked to give this computer with software, that's the whole batch, I presume, to Paul Benowitz, but not to tell Paul that the Air Force was behind it. So it sounds like a setup from the beginning. But the question, of course, is how early did all this happen, and when was this, if this even occurred? And as I must say, I don't have any evidence that it did. It's a heck of an allegation to make, to claim that Hynek would have participated in that. And many, many, many people find that extremely hard to believe. But
Well, I'm one of them. I would have to agree with that. Let's also introduce the other names, these cast of characters, for those who don't recognize them. Rick Doty is somebody I know. In fact, I solicited a comment from him about this interview for tonight that I'll get to a little bit later. But help fill in the audience about who he was and what he did.
Well, I have only spoken to Rick Doty personally one time by phone. I've exchanged a couple of emails with him. But I was told something about him as well by Ernest Edwards. Needless to say, from my understanding, Richard Doty was the agent. He was an agent for the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, stationed, I believe he'd gotten in either in late 78 or 79, somewhere in that time frame. He had come to Albuquerque. And he was the, generally, if I'm not mistaken, AFOSI is involved with a lot of on-base investigations, whether it's drug-related or other issues is the question. But my understanding is when Ernest Edwards received a call from Paul Benowitz about what he had seen in films and what he thought may be a threat, that it was referred to Richard Doty, and at that point, Richard Doty kind of became the point man who went up and spoke with Paul Benowitz. And from that point on, at least my observation seems to be, that Doty's name being available, being out there, made sure that anybody who came calling would eventually become known to Richard Doty. But to my understanding, Richard Doty was the person who, I guess, Paul had as much communication with as with Ernest Edwards, if that's the case. But Doty is the person that Bill Moore subsequently claims, I guess the word would be recruited him, to effectively inform on Paul Benowitz. So, and that puts Doty right in the middle of it. And Doty, to my understanding, to this day, Doty has come out and admitted as much, and in fact claimed that, I guess if you listen to some of the statements he's made, that, you know, Paul was an easy person to mislead. And it seems to me Doty's, once again, there are people beyond Doty. We sure don't have those names, do we? But we certainly do get Doty's name as the person who is known and who's signed some of the documents, not all, but at least one or two of them, I believe.
Okay, Rick Doty works for Air Force Office of Special Investigations,
yes.
And he basically is the point man for the Air Force in dealing with, perhaps discrediting, Paul Benowitz, the guy who's got this footage of something flying over the weapons storage area. So how did he do it? What did he do to go about doing that?
Well, there's, that, once again, the gray area. I mean, I would, if Doty wants to own up and explain what he did, that's fine. I've got the same material that I've read over the years that I've been told and things that Paul mentioned to me. But the impression that you get from everything that's been said, especially by Bill Moore himself, was that Doty was someone Bill was introduced to sometime in the middle to latter part of 1980, and Bill, who was making a name for himself as an author, had gone for whatever reason and had met Paul Benowitz, and was then funneling the information back through Richard Doty, who, perhaps in his counterintelligence role, and of course there were other people involved, not just Doty. There were other OSI agents there, and Doty has mentioned that his supervisors and several other agents were involved in this, that apparently the effort was being made to, as Bill says, defuse Paul. What they did, how they did it, there is a whole gamut of bizarre kind of things that supposedly were going on that Paul was finding out or being funneled to him through sources to make him think aliens were around, maybe aliens were in the area, aliens were back up at Dulce, being hit with these unusual beams that he, you know, my opinion is anything that if he talked about it would make people think the guy was kind of, you know, going off the deep end.
Was crazy. Yeah.
So it's effective. And my conviction has always been people in counterintelligence are people who are trained and paid to do this kind of thing. So when you're dealing with professionals and you've got the time and the money and the effort, and presumably this case was important enough. It's the only one that I know of that we know the names, Richard Doty, or potentially the other people that, you know, his bosses, went after somebody.
A private citizen who just happened to live in an area where he got video footage or photos of odd objects over a military base.
That is certainly my opinion.
And they sort of unleashed the dogs on this guy.
Yes.
I want to back up just so the audience is following this cast of characters. Benowitz is the guy who recorded the images over the base that look like flying saucers flying in and out. Rick Doty is an AFOSI agent who was assigned to deal with him. Bill Moore is a UFO researcher who won over Benowitz's confidence, but was secretly working with Rick Doty to feed bad information, disinformation, crazy information to Benowitz to help sort of destroy his credibility. Right?
That covers it pretty well. And keep in mind, there were other people involved. Other people signed the documents that everybody is familiar with. Thomas Shea signed. There are other names out there. So it was not just Doty. But my belief at this point is Doty's face was known, particularly to Paul Benowitz. You have Doty, you have Edwards, those people that he could identify, they were, I guess you would say, already outed. So if nothing else, they were people who they might as well make their names known so that if anybody came calling to ask questions, I certainly did, you would eventually call Richard Doty or get in touch with him, and he would at least be aware of who's kind of looking into the situation. But even Doty has stated other people were involved, and even up to the time in 1983 when Linda Howell kind of got involved in the story, there were other people monitoring this whole thing. So there was something about it, and it goes right back to the films Paul took on his roof, that's where it started, because he put these objects in the Air Force's backyard, and they would have had a lot of explaining to do to answer for his film that he got.
You would have to argue that they did a pretty good job of destroying his credibility and keeping him from being taken seriously, because it sounded like toward the end, what eventually happened for Paul Benowitz is he went off kind of the deep end and believed all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, anybody with some understanding of psychology would know that, that you pepper with as much truth as you can and you give them just enough information that they'll swallow everything. And I suppose if there were enough people you thought you trusted who were actually working in cahoots, I don't know what would it take for any of us to finally be unsure of what we believe, of what we know to be a fact. And I don't know, but they certainly did put the full press on Paul Benowitz, in my opinion.
Well, walk me through some of the steps, though. So at one point, Doty meets with Benowitz, and then he goes to his house, and he takes some other guy there, and while he's inside, he secretly photographs the place, right?
Yeah. Now, but keep in mind, the two things that you just mentioned, although I'm not certain of the date of the time when Doty went and met Paul at his office, but I have to believe it wouldn't wait 6 months. If he called with a potential threat, you would go immediately. So if Paul called and spoke with Ernest Edwards sometime in January, Edwards would have picked up. It's one of the reasons that I noted in the book the situation with Edwards having met, with these gentlemen later on, that he immediately passed the information up the ladder. And Edwards always told me that he felt that was his job, to get the information up the ladder or in the flow. So if he called Doty, I presume Doty or whomever would have gone and spoken with Paul Benowitz fairly soon after he called Edwards. So that would have been early in the year, presumably. Doty's story, and I think this is something people need to read closely, the story of in the document where Richard Doty and a gentleman named Jerry Miller went up and met Paul at his home, that happens later in the year, I believe October, somewhere in that time frame. It does not ever say that was the first time anybody spoke with Paul. It simply says Paul is a man who's been investigating or has had an interest in this, in UFOs in the area. Conveniently, never mentions when they got a call from Paul or when they first talked to him. But it has left everyone with the impression, and I was the same way for a long time, that, well, they wouldn't have waited. So if they went then, Paul must have called them sometime later in the year. So everything is shifting attention towards the middle of the year. But Doty at some point went and spoke with Paul. Later in the year, Doty with Jerry Miller went up there and met Paul at his home. And of course, Greg Bishop has attested to what he was told that went on, which you're correct, which is that they were photographing the inside of the house, or at least Doty presumably was. And you can only wonder why that? What would you need to know what the layout of a man's house was, or what equipment he had? And perhaps that was part of the precursor to them feeding him maybe the computer or the ability to funnel signals to him to make him wanted him to think. But there is a gap in there between, in fact, it was around April that, in my opinion, the first real strange occurrences began to occur, which was when this woman, Myrna Hansen, supposedly met and went to Paul's home, that under hypnosis, this whole story of aliens and underground bases began to suddenly unfold.
And he goes for it, hook, line, and sinker. And some lady shows up with this wild tale about Dulce underground bases. She gets hypnotically regressed. She tells the story to Benowitz, and he buys it.
Yes, and so you should see, there's really not any foundation for the entire underground base story until this situation came up, in which, once again, under a regressive hypnosis, apparently, a woman claims that she, and even then, she just claimed she was, if I'm not mistaken, taken to some underground or some huge cavernous facility. But I have my own questions about how this came about because of the perfect convenience of a woman who ends up at Paul's home claiming that she had had some experiences right up in this area where he had been interested in 6 months before, and that certainly ratcheted his attention right back off of, you know, the Kirtland area, right back up into this whole area around Dulce and whatnot. So it just shifted attention, his attention notably, right back, you know, to the place he had been before where, you know, who knows what was going on up there at the time.
How would you say, help the listeners understand, how did they convince, Benowitz that he was intercepting messages or signals from aliens?
Well, it's interesting because it's something that's come up in the last month or two since some messages were posted on another forum. And actually, the question of what was he seeing on these computer screens that he had and what signals was he getting? And interestingly enough, Gabe Valdez, unfortunately he's passed away, but his son Greg had contacted me and another friend of mine, and apparently was able to kind of give some idea of what these images look like on the screen, although I've heard that some of them were very clear. And I don't know what computer technology was back in 1980 or how good the graphics cards were, but of course, what exactly he was getting, some of them looked to be the small snapshots that he had just taken up off the screen. And if this was a screen that he was given ostensibly by the Air Force or whomever else, you know, my take has always been that to be able to decode a signal, to have software to decode a signal, you already have to know kind of what the signal is going to be. And that would seem to me to be a ready-made situation for him to have something, especially if the story of people having snuck into his home to examine his equipment, you know, is correct when he wasn't home, makes you really wonder whether they gave him a computer with some equipment, they kind of knew what he had, they knew how he would potentially get the signal, and then they just broadcast the signal to him that they know he's going to see. Or maybe the pictures were already on the computer. That's very difficult to know, and I don't know of anyone who, well, unless somebody could get their hands on that computer equipment today, who's to say what he got. But it's just all so questionable. And to me, the effect of all of it was anytime he spoke of it to anyone else, especially the fact that it had such little real foundation to it, it was hard to know. How can you prove where the pictures were coming from, what the signals were? At that point, and of course, then the NSA comes into the picture, at least at that day, the NSA was a big, you know, big topic in its own right with James Bamford's book. And I think it was a convenient thing to just put the term NSA out there, knowing that most people in ufology and anyone else with an interest in this thing would jump all over that.
Okay, yeah, the story has many tentacles from here. So Paul Benowitz has people come into his home and secretly photograph it. There are indications that people came in when he wasn't there. He starts getting fed disinformation to think that he's communicating or intercepting signals from space aliens, and he comes a little bit unhinged. We'll pick up the story, including a comment from Agent Rick Doty right after this. REM taking us into the break with Orange Crush, and it's not a song about the soda. Stay with us, everyone, on Coast to Coast AM.